Right now, there it goes, it's recording. So all your questions are now being in the, are going to be in the background of this recording. Probably better not to do that. All right, so we pretty much covered a rapid stroll through the history of the development of the importance of HR. And as you can see, essentially what we're talking about here is the meeting of two forces, one of which is that the way people were being handled in the U.S. historically was not efficient in terms of the versus relationship, obviously, combined with the fact that we were entering into an international where we have increasing competition from companies located in lands where human resource costs are extremely low. So that brought us to the point where HR began to see that it had a place and that it should be an important component in what the company is using to plan for its future, in other words, its strategy. So what I want to do now, basically for the rest of the semester, is to try to go over these points that I sort of, I think, mentioned briefly yesterday in terms of the idea of planning and hiring and training and all that kind of stuff. And we need to try to maximize how we do that. And in large part, I mentioned, I think, yesterday in this class, is that one of the things you need to do is to set aside your normal proclivities in choices. Your normal way of choosing your friends, or your normal way of choosing people to be on your team, or the normal way of saying, oh, I'm glad that guy's my neighbor and not the other guy, or whatever. Those ways of choosing are ways that are most likely not job-related, and you'll hear that term a lot this semester, are usually not job-related. And it brings up interesting questions such as, why do we do job interviews? My argument is with job interviews that, and this is just sort of to reinforce my point, that the actual interview process is contrary to looking at a person's past job history, looking at their references, talking to their references, maybe giving them a structured job test of some sort. Because what happens is when you meet with people, you let in your human feelings about that person, and that can also often be a pollutant to finding the best person for the job, if you understand what I'm saying. So, for example, last fall, I decided to have a new roof put on my house, a metal roof. And I had a couple guys come over and bid it, and then I had a guy came over with an old pickup truck, as these guys generally sport, but he had a Philadelphia Eagles license plate on the front. And I sent a picture of it. I said, this guy's got the job already, right? Well, it turned out he was only so-so, and then before he could finish, he died, and that took care of that, so I had to finish it myself on the roof. But that's how you get a polluted decision-making process, right? I was won over by the Philadelphia Eagles front license plate. Anybody from Philadelphia who likes the Eagles got to be a buddy of mine when it comes to putting on a roof. He had an okay references. So we have to get away from our human tendencies in large part to try to pick out who's best for the job. Now, it can be, of course, that something like enthusiasm or creativity or whatever, something you need to assess face-to-face, perhaps, might be an important part of the job, in which case, then that's what you look for. You ignore the fact that the person may be wearing an Eagles T-shirt or whatever, and you look to see whether they're enthusiastic, creative, whatever. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't have interviews. I'm just saying that you can easily pollute your job search by doing interviews. One time I was on a committee that was to choose people for the Chancellor's Scholarship. Have you heard of this? It's a pretty good damn deal, to say the least. It's basically you get a lot of good stuff out of it. And we interviewed a whole bunch of people, And we had a student on the group of five or six of us. There's at least one student, maybe another. And the students wanted to give one of the scholarships to the fellow who I thought was completely unqualified, but he had a garage band, and they thought that was pretty cool. Whatever. So be careful. You know, once you establish a good selection process, and we'll go into a good bit of talk about that, how you put together a good selection process, we'll call valid selection procedure, you know, be careful not to pollute it. All right, so let's start here back again at time one, and we know that we're trying to get over here to time two, and we also know that there's going to be a small, a medium, or a large change in our employee makeup, so to speak. That change, of course, can be in skills, so we may need new skills. New skills, and we also may need more or less employees. So we have a lot to think about here as we start from a human resources point of view, as we move the organization time one to time two, whatever that might happen to be. And look at the difficulty of doing this correctly. I mean, it's a monumental task when you start to really dig into it. Once you learn about the various areas in which you can do something wrong, you realize how difficult this is to do. It's not an easy thing to do. Most of us think, well, I can judge what a person's like. Right, I know when a person's going to be a good employee, or I know when a person's going to be just the person we need for selling our product or whatever, and I would hasten to tell you that that's not the case. Most of us don't know and can't tell who a good employee will be on into the future, without putting together a whole screening process. All right, and I mentioned to you before that we might look at more or less, if we need to change this number, we may have to do some layoffs, right? And in the process of laying off employees, we need to lay off people who would not be valuable to us in the future based on where we want to be. We don't want to lay off the wrong people. This has happened during the period of time when there was a big crunch and people were experiencing layoffs, and they would invite consultants in to lay people off. A guy by the name of Chainsaw Al Dunlap was a big hitter in this area. He was really good at coming in and laying off a third of your workforce, or a half of your workforce. And he got the big bucks for doing that, and he just grossly laid off people. And 6 months later, of course, the company was now bereft of the people that they needed, and they would have to hire the same people back as some form of consultant or help at extra money, an extra high pay, to get the people to come back. So not only did they fire the wrong people, they then paid the price of having to bring this person back and then pay, you know, Chainsaw Al $1 million for taking care of all of this. So the whole concept is really kind of stupid. It has to be very, very surgically done when you're going to cut. So if we're laying off people here from a less point of view, we want to make sure that we're laying people off in a legal fashion, in an accurate skills fashion, and in an accurate numbers fashion. Can you see some of the problems that you might be associated with laying people off from a legal point of view? Well, companies tend to say, well, let's take a look at this group of employees that all do the same thing, engineer design, designer, let's call it. We look at all the designers, what might a company want to do if they're trying to save money? But the really skilled designers might be the expensive designers. Do you see my point? So So what they tend to do in a layoff situation is look for people with a higher salary and then ax those people, surprisingly enough. It's because then they'll save more money, see? And the idea, of course, of any corporation is always to save money. I'm being facetious. So what we're looking at here is a typical person who has not taken my class, who thinks the best way to do it is just can all the people that are costing a lot of money. Well, who are the people that are costing a lot of money? As you mentioned, they could be high-skilled people that were promoted based on their skills or given extra money as rewards, pay increases because of their good work. So you're losing highly skilled people. Who else are going to be the highly skilled people? I mean, the highly paid people, sorry.
Executives.
Well, within a job category. Let's say this is the designer group.
Managers.
Let's say they're all the same level, basically. But some of them are making a lot more money than others. Thank you. And the people who have been there the longest are going to be the people who are, begins with an O. Older. And if you decide to lay off all the people who seem to be high paid and a disproportionate number of those people are older, those people are all going to be clamoring to their own lawyers to have a protection claim made under the ADEA, Age Discrimination and Employment Act. It's called indirect adverse impact, adverse treatment under Title VII. So we'll be talking about this. My point only is to say you can't do this in a slipshod, knee-jerk fashion. There's too many negative ramifications that can haunt you, come back to bite you in the elbow when the time comes. So be careful here. People who have been fired, for example, usually, if you were to think of them as some sort of emoticon, these would be, which one of these pictures looks like the person who's been fired? A. And a person who's been fired who's upset is going to do what? Anything they can to get back at the company, particularly if it involves a settlement involving money. And an ADEA claim could bring them a fair amount of money if they were not, you know, shouldn't have been laid off or were not carefully laid off. So be careful about this stuff. All right, so that's some of the stuff, not to mention that you might lay off too many people. And laying off, also from a public relations point of view, it's detrimental as well. Oh, I wouldn't want to work for that company. They lay off masses of people. Also, there are various regulations that require you to give a period of time warning to a company of large enough size, we'll talk about it later, when you're going to go lay off people. So there's issues about that. It has to be done with enough time before the axe actually falls. Gives them a chance to find a job, et cetera. In terms of more, who do we want to hire to do the, we have these jobs that we need to fill over here. And so we want to hire people, either internally or externally, who can, I'll fill in the next word, do, you, the, and you fill in the next word. Job, any one of these particular jobs. You want to hire people who can do the jobs that are within your goal. Your strategy then, from an HR strat point of view, is to accurately hire the people who are needed to do the jobs out there at time two. Not simply just to hire people, but to hire people who have the particular skills, aptitudes, abilities, and interests, et cetera, to do the job. This then would mean that you have to have what about these jobs?
Knowledge.
Pardon?
Knowledge.
Knowledge, even better, information.
Well, yeah.
You know, information that has the fine detail of what's required by these jobs. And we get this, and we're going to talk about this probably next time, from what's known as a job analysis. The job analysis gives us fine-grained detail about the job, and then we can take the applicants that are applying internally or externally, and hold those applicants up and compare them to the job analysis to see whether or not they can do the job. And we break it down into skills and abilities that are required for a particular job and look at the various indicators that a person may or may not be able to do the job. Okay, so as you can see then, this becomes an ongoingly, increasingly difficult situation. Because now we need job analysis of each one of these jobs that we're hiring for, and we need to make sure that they're distilled in a way that can be used to look at applicants, and then go ahead and bring the applicants in. And in the background, keeping in mind the number of people we need and the legal considerations surrounding these decisions. It ain't easy. Okay. So, if we're going to hire internally, we talked about the positive factors associated with internal hires, right? The fact that it keeps morale up, it gives people goals, they already know the organization. Do we talk about that at all? I thought we did. People are looking a little blank. But in any case, in an internal hire, we do have advantages. It shows employees that they have a future with us, that they could, theoretically, move up to a better job. It allows us to keep people who understand the culture and how the organization is run, the communications network, et cetera, we don't have to reestablish that with these people. And from the point of view of hiring and recruiting, it's a good thing, too. If we're doing external hiring and recruiting, we can say, you know, take a look at this particular job we promote solely from within. All you have to do is get yourself into that situation. You could be with the company for a long period of time. People want job stability these days. So, there's a lot of value here. And this internal hiring, then, is what's known as making our new employees, and we're making them out of our old employees. Making our employees who are suitable to be made into the new employees that we need, with all the value that's associated with that. Of course, the problem lies if we can't take internal employees and make them into doing the new job, whatever the new job happens to be. And that needs to be carefully weighed against the idea of building people's excitement up about working for the company and this and that. But if you can't accurately train a person to be in that new job, if there's no real match between existing skills, if there's no match between our existing skills that our employees have and the new jobs, then we need to reconsider whether internal employees being made to that job are appropriate. If not, then we need to go to external sources, which, as I mentioned yesterday, was the relevant labor market, to search for people that we can buy. So it's a make or buy decision. Can we buy the people that we need? There's a lot of risk associated with this. We don't know them. We're taking a risk that we're going to hire somebody that really doesn't fit the organization. And, of course, if we're in a company that's doing something that's important, you're an app company, you're designing new apps, what's going to happen to the pay required by those new people that you're thinking about buying? What do you think? They're going to be expensive. That's as good a word as any for it. And some of you may remember back in the time when things were really blowing up in Silicon Valley, getting exciting and hot in Silicon Valley, people that were going to work for some of these startup firms were getting leases on BMW convertibles to come to work for this company. Right? And it was an enticing thing for a young person to drive around in a BMW convertible. As you get older, you realize it's a situation where you drive around, you get skin cancer. It's a lot less exciting. And I lived with convertibles as a kid. A whole fleet of them, as a matter of fact, now that I think back on it. I don't think I ever wore a hat at the time. Again, how you go about attracting people is going to be predicated on what the people that you need. If you're trying to attract young or old or California versus East Coast, it's all very different. And you need to be aware of how you attract people in the relevant labor market from which you expect to draw a certain level of employee. Okay, so now as we move to this concept of filling these jobs here, I said that we need this job analysis. The job analysis is essentially a detailed understanding of our job. Yes. It's a detailed understanding of our job. It's essentially an analysis of our job. Appropriately enough, an analysis of our job, whatever it might happen to be that we're trying to fill. And that job analysis, just to help motivate you, job analysis helps us get our most qualified applicants. Job analysis helps us get our most qualified applicants. It gives us the methodology by which to create performance appraisals. In other words, you have to have the details in order to do accurate performance appraisal. If a person comes in and says, "How did I do on my job?" and you say, "Oh, you did great. We had a great time when we all went to dinner together. We sat around and drank craft beer and ate kielbasa. We had a good time together. And I remember you and I were talking about the Philadelphia Eagles and how they're going to the Super Bowl. And I agree with you 100%. And I've agreed with every applicant for the last 30 years on this topic. But with you, I'm sure it's going to happen. And also that our kids play on the same T-ball team. There's a winner there. So now we're hiring on topics that are not within the job analysis. And that goes into this here. We get what we want. And the performance appraisal, we appraise them against the actual things that are within the job analysis, not the fact that we had dinner together and drank craft beer. Right? So we have accuracy here. And also, that leads to legal terminations. It also leads to court support for our actions. If I say, you, and you are getting a pay raise, you, and you are not getting a pay raise, what could the possible outcome be from the point of a legal situation?
Say they discriminatory.
They might claim that they were being discriminated against based on protected group status. Exactly. And you, in order to fight that concept, well, first of all, what are they going to say? They're going to say, look at all the people that got raises. They're all some protected group, race or religion or gender, or whatever. The people who didn't are on the other side of the coin, whatever it might happen to be. So what's the company going to have to demonstrate then? They're going to have to demonstrate the decision made to give dollar awards was based on these performance appraisals, not on the fact that one group was all men and the other group was all women or whatever, or vice versa.
What's that word next to most qualified applicants, performance appraisal?
the far right. Most qualified, well, accuracy, right? Legal terminations, accuracy, right? Court support wants to see acceptable reasons for company actions. Okay. So the job analysis then is this idea of understanding what we want to have accomplished in the company through the jobs, and then using the details to match the person to those details of what they can and can't do. How do we do it? How do we do job analysis? It's a good thing for you guys to realize, because quite often entry-level employees get an assignment of doing the job analysis. So you need to have a fairly good understanding of how to do this so that you can do one that's useful to the company and build your own credibility in an organization. Well, how would you suggest that we learn everything about a job?
Do it.
Pardon?
Do it.
I mean, there's certainly you could people that are supposed to be doing the analysis could step up and try doing the job. That's not too bad an idea. I was with my traveling buddy at the time, Preston Powell, who I've mentioned to you before as your student body vice president, who's done so well and is bringing jobs back to Kentucky, this and that. And he and I were over there for different reasons. I was inspecting plants, shoe manufacturing plants, and he was working for the shoe manufacturer. So we were met up over there and went around to these plants, and as usual, you're driven everywhere in these situations. And we were in a plant one time where shoes are being manufactured. And Preston says, I wonder, it smells kind of strong in here. And one of the things we ended up recommending was more ventilation. He said, I wonder if that's detrimental to working conditions. He said, I'm going to find out. So he went out onto the shop floor where they were putting shoes together and sat next to a young woman who was making shoes. She, of course, was totally embarrassed, as you might imagine. But he sat there, came back in after about 15 minutes. He said, I had a splitting headache within 5 minutes. Well, he got to know the job, that's for sure. And he found out that some of the hazards associated with this needed to be mitigated. So one of the things that I said was, for ventilation, called edge hood ventilation. Pulls the air up on the edge of the hood and shoots it out. Anyway, so that's one way of finding out about a job. Do it. Sit there. Watch it. So you're doing the job, you would learn stuff. Watching the job and making a detailed list of what's done so that we can figure out what the skills are associated with that. What else could we do? Who could we talk to, for example? We could ask the employee, right? You know, what does this job involve? More on that later. We might talk to the supervisor. What else? By the way, this is called job incumbent. Always want to use terms if we possibly can. Job incumbent could give us a discussion about what a job entailed. What were they doing? What were they thinking? We could, as we're watching the job, we want to make sure that we watched it for a long enough period of time until it repeats its cycle. So we want to see the complete cycle. Doing the job would be the same thing. Do the complete cycle of the job so you can begin to understand it. The supervisor would give us some ideas of things that we didn't know about or couldn't see, extra stuff perhaps, or things that they look for particularly in terms of determining whether or not an employee is doing a good job at manufacturing, in my case, shoes and furniture, two different trips. We could also perhaps do a video of people doing this job and see which ones seem to be doing it best and why they're doing it better than other people are doing it. Have they left out steps that are unimportant? You okay?
Yeah.
Good. So that would work too. You could, in certain types of jobs that aren't too easy to see, have them do a workplace, what's known as workplace diary. So a person sits for a while, does the job, and then writes down what they've been doing. All this would be a way to gather information.
Yeah. Can you compare figures like with other like related factories, for instance? Could you like look at those figures to see
in other words, let's say they had a time thing, that each cycle takes, 25 minutes to manufacture something. And it would be interesting to talk to other companies to find out how long their cycle takes as well. So that might be useful, comparative others, so to speak. And if they're doing it a lot faster, why? Or a lot slower, why are we doing it better, et cetera. So if you did the comparison, you'd have to take something out of it, not just that they're doing it faster, we're doing it faster, whatever, but learn something from that. Okay, so we have the idea of job diaries. A person writes down what they're doing. If you're looking at executives, managers, sometimes they just sit and write things for long periods of time. You need to know what they're thinking about, what's going into what they're writing, et cetera. So all that becomes important. Now, I'm well aware of the fact that job analysis is going to be one of the least exciting things in your life for the next week or so. But the reality is it's fundamental to HR, fundamental from an efficiency, accuracy point of view, and particularly fundamental from a legal point of view. So please use toothpicks to hold your eyes open, if at all possible, to absorb this stuff and listen to the tapes carefully, too. All right, so we gather all this information up. A couple points. When we talk to employees, it's important that we talk to a lot of employees because some employees might be better, some employees are skipping an important step, etc. So we get a better view of a job if we talk to 15 employees than if we talk to one. Right? Plus, the more employees you talk to, the more the employees will accept the information that you found because you were considering their point of view as well. So, you want to look at the number. You get a good number of people on here. You want a supervisor who's been doing this for some period of time. The video should be probably of several or more employees doing this particular job so that you can study, if needed, frame by frame to see how it's going, where somebody's doing it differently and therefore faster or slower than somebody else. The workplace diary is only going to work if a person is articulate and can write down what they're doing accurately, etc. So the gathering of data here for the job analysis, of course, is crucial. Garbage in, garbage out, the expression. So here's a situation where we certainly could have bad garbage going in. If you talk to the employee, what's the employee's tendency? What's the employee's tendency when you ask them about their job? The human tendency to make their job sound more important than it actually might. Well, I just sweep up around the machinery here, and it looks kind of simple. I've got a broom. I see paper. I sweep it up, and I put it in a barrel, and we throw it away. Now we recycle it, of course. But let's think, what happens if I don't clean up around the machine? Somebody comes walking along, they trip on a piece of paper, plunge headfirst into the machine grinds up their body and puts it into the product is now all pink, nobody will buy it anymore, and so for a month or two we can't sell any product, and our quarterly report looks like crap, and so the investors flee like rats from a ship, and we don't get the returns that we're supposed to have, and therefore the stock goes to rock bottom. All because I didn't sweep up around the machine. Makes sense to me. I'm buying it. So, But I'm just saying there's this tendency towards self-aggrandizement here. So be careful. Supervisors, too, will do the same thing because if they're supervising a more important job, well, that makes them more important. Anyway. So be careful about this kind of thing. You really need to weed out the facts from the fiction here. So now let's say we have a whole barrel here of information about this job from a whole bunch of people sort of randomly thrown into this bucket. Facts about the job. That needs to be put into some order. It needs to be taken off the handle. Yeah, I'm sorry. It needs to be distilled, get rid of things that are similar, right, and boil it down to maybe 20 key points about the job. And in the boiling it down process, we need to have not just us, but a number of people, perhaps even including supervisor and various others, looking at this data, trying to compress it into a useful document. And typically, as we put this document together, I'm just going to give you these thoughts to have over the weekend with you. You want to look at the major and the minor. Responsibilities of this job. Well, the major and the minor responsibilities of the job. If I, oh, here we go. This will be an amusing way to finish off this class. Okay. Let's pretend that the job is undergraduate student in a business school. And I said, what do you do in your job as undergraduate in a business school? Let's list 20 things that you do or 10 things that you do. And then we'll go into an understanding of major versus minor.
Go to class.
Not go. Use the right word. I'm trying to increase sophistication in your vocabulary.
Attend a classroom session, lectures.
Attend. This is any listen, any order, it doesn't matter. Just stuff that you do as a requirement for being a student at ASU in the business school.
Obtain knowledge on career.
Career. Info. Keep going. Pardon?
Collaborating with fellow students.
Yeah, same thing. Keep going.
Good word. Perform academic tasks.
See how you all focus on the classroom when there's really a much bigger word out world out there? What is it? Pardon? What?
I feel like I'm looking at a LinkedIn.
Extracurricular.
Learn time management.
I had a kid named, well, just his first name, Steve. First 4.0 student I had. Genius. I couldn't believe this kid. I've had like three geniuses in 27 years. I mean, unmitigated geniuses. One kid took summer OB from me. Sat in the back of the room, really nice kid, cool kid. Sat in the back room, never took any notes, just sort of gazed up at the ceiling, occasionally wrote a little something in a notebook. And on every test, perfect tests. Everything was perfect. And my tests are really son of a guns that they were right. And he got everything else. His term paper, outstanding. Some people are just really smart. I had a 15th, did I tell you about this? The kid I had in college as my first roommate. I'm like 18, the kid's 15. I said, Don, what are you doing here? He said, oh, I skipped a few classes and I went along. I said, oh, really? And he's like, you know, big, thick glasses and goofy looking and whatever. First term paper, freshman. First term paper, he has turned in nothing. He hasn't done a thing, nothing. He's, you know, we didn't have any computers, and he's farting around doing other stuff, you know, eating or something. Nothing. night before the paper's due, he goes out to the common room in the dorm where all these kids are talking and BSing. He sits down with a typewriter, which is what we had, and types verbatim from his mind to the paper. Next morning, he turns it in, which would be a recipe for disaster in most cases. I said, "Don, how'd that paper go?" A couple weeks later, he said, "Oh, I just got it back. I did pretty well." I said, "How'd it go?" He said, "Well, here, take a look." He hands it to me. Swear to God, it's the truth. Top of the paper, it says A plus. Then underneath it says, "The best paper I've ever got from an undergraduate student in 15 years.
Which is how old he is.
Yeah. That really said something.
It all started,
I mean, this is a certifiable genius. Anyway, and I didn't really understand the topic. It was some person in history that he was writing about. I mean, unbelievable. But these people exist. I don't know how I got on to this. All right, so we're talking about what you guys do in class, right? What else? That's it? You know, if you followed this, you know how long you'd be here? Less than a day. Who would come to take you away? Campus security. Because you had not
paid tuition.
Paid tuition. Well, yeah. And don't you have to have some sort of shot now?
You have to have insurance, too.
Insurance?
Yeah, our kid sends us an email about it every day.
Insurance? What kind of insurance?
Health insurance.
Yeah, it's mandatory.
And keep going. Here's one that you always forget. Pay library fines. You ain't graduating without that.
Yeah, I gotta do
just
that.
To let you know. Parking fines, too. They're real big on that. But they used to be a lot bigger when they could keep the money. Now they don't get to keep the money. But when they could keep the money, they were huge on parking fines. Now it's a little less so.
What do they have to do now?
They have to give it to a central group that then distributes it to secondary schools.
Football team?
Okay. What else? That's it? Come on.
Sleep deprivation.
Huh?
Sleep deprivation.
You make, say it in a better way. Like, one, you want to maximize the utility of available hours.
Yeah.
Use your time well.
Yeah, let's do that.
Time use.
Time use.
Time utilization, even better.
Yeah.
I like it. All right, so what we have here is a random, though rather short, list on, don't you have to eat?
Yeah. No.
Don't you have to
not
sleep? Sometimes. Just ramen noodles out of the box, right?
I don't know.
Is water necessary for ramen noodles?
Yeah.
Some people do eat them
dry.
No,
some people
eat
them
dry.
I've heard that.
Like, I mean,
rice,
weird.
Like
the
rice cake, it's a little bit.
The water's free.
Australian
like.
Rice cakes are really good.
I think
okay,
time
use. But my point is here that these would all be sort of a list, and there would be many others. But we would need to organize this into major and minor responsibilities. And the major and the minor responsibilities are based on the fact that, I'll put it here, major responsibility is supported by minor's responsibilities. So, for example, attend class is not a major responsibility. Passing class is a major responsibility so that you can then go on to other courses. So attending class and writing the papers and turning in the homework and polishing the professor's 2006 Sienna that's parked out on the lot, usually at around site 100, those kinds of things are required to pass the class. What else would you see here? What would you call that then? That first major responsibility would be a pass class. And then you'd have those listings under here. Attend, grade, attendance, grades, papers, etc. What would be another major responsibility? What would that be under the major responsibility of? Along with library fines and all that kind
financial
of stuff.
Financial obligations?
I would say administrative requirements might be better. So meet administrative requirements might be here. Meet admin REQ apostrophe D. Requirements, maybe that's a T, isn't it? So meet administrative requirements would be tuition, library fines, insurance, etc. And making sure that you took the appropriate classes for your major, etc. See what I mean? So that's a major and it's minor responsibilities. The minor responsibilities support the completion of the major responsibility. But in many cases, at least, you don't have to do them all. For example, can you pass a class without attending it?
Yeah.
I'm the first example for that. Anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania, I went for each test and the final. That was it. I wasn't going to attend. I didn't feel like it. I had other things to do. My granny got me that Corvette. I had a Norton motorcycle. It was geared to do 80 miles an hour top speed, so you can imagine the acceleration. Yes?
Yeah, they had some paper classes at UNC you didn't have to go to, and you always get an A.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Like, you know the year the basketball team won the championship the last time?
Oh, yeah.
I think they had 17 out of 27 people on the roster in that class, and all of them got A.
Wow. I missed it.
That's why I was doing investigation.
I signed up for the classes that all required that you be there, and then everybody gets a D.
I tried to get him to do a class like that.
No?
It's called geology.
How about the public speaking classes and all the communications classes? Aren't they pretty good? They'd be pretty easy.
I don't know. Some people on my team are like...
You like coffee? All right, so my point is here to distinguish between major and minor responsibilities. Okay, so you can understand that we're going to take that bag of information, that pot of information that we have about a job, and look at them and determine what are the major responsibilities and what then are the supporting minor responsibilities that fall out. And typically, there's not more than about maybe 5 or 7 major responsibilities. Everything else a person does falls under the supportive component of those major responsibilities. Okay, now it's time for you to do your extracurricular work over the weekend. Now. I'll see you all Tuesday.
Like perfect.